This week, the U.S. high-tech shares index was one of the few markets to close in the green column. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you for this August 10th show. Another two big guest interviews, episode 655. In episode 655, we review a week that most investors wish they could forget. A week that will live in
infamy, infamy, infamy.
Commodities, most stocks, even our beloved cryptocurrencies, almost every sector suffered except the tech shares and the dollar. To help us decode just what the financial markets are telling us, two unique industry professionals, including Wolf Richter, founder of WolfStreet.com. He holds silver in his investment portfolio. He does see sunnier economic prospects, particularly due to the domestic manufacturing, transportation, service, and housing sectors. Plus, Bill Murphy from GATA says precious metals investors will ultimately be victorious for their patience as we try to get through these typical summer doldrums. He thinks the next rally could be explosive. We discussed the hyperinflation unfolding in Caracas, Venezuela, where a dozen eggs that cost just a few bolivars now cost $3 million. That's 1,000,000% inflation in Maduro's. And we'd like for you to record your questions on our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear editorial. Goldseek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies persisted over the precious metals sector this week as investors turned to the greenback instead on stronger than expected consumer price index and producer price index figures from the Labor Department. Gold gave back $4, finishing at $12.19. Silver relinquished just 17 cents, ending at $15.30, while the XAU precious metals shares index dropped sharply by 3% off 220, finishing at $73.87. Black gold gave back 86 cents, finishing at $67.63 per barrel. The Bitcoin ETF was off about 5.5%, half a dollar, finishing at $9.60, not too far from support, but weak technically. GoldSeek is still keeping a close eye on the Halo tokens. We continue to follow the Halo project with interest. The top story moving the precious metal sector, gold prices on Friday finished another challenging week. Amid a sharp jump in the U.S. dollar, which stemmed from concerns on contagion from an escalating currency crisis in our NATO ally, Turkey. The U.S. dollar topped its year record on lower confidence in the Turkish lira on news the U.S. would double steel and aluminum tariffs on the nation. Global markets tumbled as well in the wake of the Financial Times report that the European Central Bank officials are warning of exposure to European banks from their neighbor nation, Turkey. The U.S. dollar rallied to a new high on Friday as a key currency safe haven. Plus, news of new U.S. sanctions on Russia roiled the bear nation's markets, increasing uncertainty in financial circles as threats of new tariffs were levied on virtually all of our U.S. allies. Turning to domestic news, gold firmed following the government Labor Department inflation report. The core CPI index was well above the Fed's 2% target at 2.4%, the highest in a decade. The latest U.S. consumer pricing data showed another rise in the cost of living, up 0.2% in July, adding to expectations of further rate hikes. And our PPI index was strong as well. Inflation is typically viewed as a positive for gold in the long term, sheltering investors from lost purchasing power. Yet in the near term, the threat of rate hikes to offset inflation does improve the appeal of alternative yielding paper assets. Current Fed funds futures odds at the St. Louis Fed show 94% probability at the next meeting slated for September, and a 67% probability of a rate hike at the December meeting, and it looks currently like there might be one more rate hike next year, according to the Fed's figures. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, although the favorable holiday season is approaching, the U.S. dollar is clearly on the cusp of a key breakout after months of building momentum. Until the dollar advance pauses and the XAU shares index firm, caution is advisable. One caveat, all the global turmoil brewing should encourage investors to be considering precious metals as an investment life jacket. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on the heels of a five-week rally. Investors booked some profits. The Dow Jones finished off just 150, ending at 25,313, still above that psychological support level of 25,000. The S&P 500 was off just 7, ending at 2833. Total second quarter earnings expected to be up 25%. That's the best growth figure in 8 years. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite bucked the trend, gaining 8 days in a row, its best advance in a year. Narrowly holding on to gains Friday, 27 points higher at 78.39, about 50% higher than the year 2000 peak. The top story impacting U.S. equities, the continued trade war fears between the United States and its trading partner China, Russia, as well as Turkey, furthered investor nervousness. News that Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev threatened Washington that Russia views these new sanctions as a declaration of economic war further concerned investors. The Chinese Minister of Commerce announced a 25% tariff on $16 billion of U.S. goods, including a list of 333 U.S. items, such as passenger cars, motorcycles, various fuels, and optical cables. U.S. officials retaliated with a list of 279 Chinese import products subject to 25% tariffs of $16 billion, which could be implemented on August 23rd. This is the second phase of the original $50 billion tariffs proposed on Chinese imports. China has already imposed 25% tariffs on $34 billion of U.S. imports. The Chinese government warned the United States about this protracted trade war. There's that word again, trade war, economic war we keep hearing from our allies, noting that it would match us on additional tariffs. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, although the equities advance stalled somewhat this week as expected in the last report, the 7 indicator greed to fear index at USA Today shows that the pendulum is still in the greedy category, but not excessively so for about the third week running. After this pullback passes, it still looks highly possible that we could see new highs again in U.S. shares in the coming months. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Gold prices edged higher last Friday on the heels of a stronger GDP number. Joining me with his latest market commentary, Bill Murphy runs the Gold Antitrust Action Committee. Got it. With Chris Powell keeping the markets honest. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Good to be here, Chris. Thank you.
So top story moving the precious metals markets. Last week we saw some strong numbers that might indicate maybe some inflation coming down the pike. What do you see in the markets?
Well, a lot of us think that the real inflation in the United States is being understated based on the numbers they put out there. I mean, I think eventually all of a sudden it's going to hit home all at once and people are going to realize that it has been greater, and that's where, you know, how gold and silver will benefit.
Obviously, the Fed and their colleagues are concerned about inflation. They may not admit it, but why else would they be raising rates? I mean, we've seen several rate hikes, probably two more. If we look at the Fed funds futures, it seems to indicate the September FOMC meeting, probably once again at the December, hopefully tapering off into next year. So obviously, there are some concerns about rates. Plus, we have a flattening of the yield curve, which tends to precede recessions. And if that inverts, like a lot of analysts are calling for next year, that certainly would bode well. But back on inflation, Venezuela down in Caracas there, South America, hyperinflation is out of control. I mean, 1,000,000% inflation? How does the everyday middle class and working class citizen survive in that type of environment?
Beyond my scope, it's mind-boggling. I mean, it almost sounds not real. I mean, we saw that in Africa a while back, and it's reached South America.
Zimbabwe trillion-dollar notes, I believe, and even $100 trillion notes. Any time when they lose control of the currency, you run into starvation, having to resort to things they never thought possible to keep bread on the table, to keep the lights on. I don't know exactly what's going on down there, but I know President Maduro recently had a drone attack. Did you see this? They actually had explosive drones in public chasing the president around, and one actually exploded.
All I could say is that was a bad day for him.
A bad day or a good day. I mean, he survived, and I guess it depends on your perspective. But moving on here, I think I should have mentioned, though, that a price of a dozen eggs has gone from just a few bolivars to 2.6 million bolivars. To give people an idea, I imagine paying $3 million for a dozen eggs. Also wanted to ask you about what's going on with China. You know, we obviously have a weak yuan, strong dollar. Ambrose Pritchard in Great Britain just mentioned that he thinks there is essentially a cold war going on between our president and China, that their People's Bank of China holding treasury reserves about $3 trillion now, which is more than I would have guessed, $1 or $2 trillion. That's an enormous amount of firepower they have. They could always pull the nuclear option, which Jim Rickards mentioned just this week on one of the major outlets, that China might just pull the nuclear option and start to dump our debt, trillions of dollars of debt they've accumulated as we used our worthless money to buy their valuable goods for the past two or three decades. Do you see this as a potential inflationary moment on the horizon?
Well, of course it could be, but, you know, we've been hearing stuff about China years, year after year after year. China's going to do this. China can do that. You know, the different exchanges are all going to be meaningful in terms of impact on the gold price, and nothing ever happens.
One wonders this time, though, we've actually maybe started the unpardonable sin in their eyes, fighting back with tariffs and saying, hey, we're going to tax your $500 billion worth of imports that we bring into our country if you don't get in line. You know, it's been tit for tat, back and forth. Every nasty move we've made, they've gone right by the statistical analysis playbook, ratcheting up the Eurozone, is ratcheting up Russia, is ratcheting up. There's been a lot of decades of mistakes made in our trade balance, if you will. But do we have to just pull out the heavy artillery? Could this not have been done through negotiation and diplomacy?
Well, you never know. You know, these things all of a sudden don't matter much. And the next thing you know, one thing else is done and all heck breaks loose. And certainly there is that potential, and that's the risk that a number of people are concerned about when they're talking about the tariff issue.
You know, it seems like a game of chicken to me. The U.S. still has dollar hegemony, at least I think in the eyes of most people, all that's fading quickly as new trade strategies and programs are being set up all around Asia and the Middle East. But still, we have dollar hegemony. Is that enough to give us this sort of ality to say, if you want to trade with us, it's going to be on our terms? I just can't help but wonder if it might backfire.
Well, it's just it's a quiet summertime, and for me, I guess the important issue is whether gold can hold 1,200 and silver 15, and they've built some minor bases here now after they've broken down from some pretty decent tops, and so we need some excitement on the upside to ensure that those, you know, bases remain intact and so on, and need a little bit of independent strength, because 8 weeks ago tomorrow is when the gold cartel attacked and took gold down below 1,300 and silver from 1,723 to where it is today. During that whole period of time, the dollar didn't do a thing. Just recently, now it's moved up above 95, and that's our critical area, and we'll see if it's going to continue moving from here or whether it's a false breakout. But like a lot of other people, I think once the summer ends, you know, we're going to have quite an interesting, you know, fall, and the prices are going to start to rise dramatically. But it's my opinion, I think I might have said this before, that when we go up next time, I don't think it's going to be gradual. We're either going to, when we do move, and we will, it's going to be sharp and it'll be explosive.
The bulls are still going to have their metal tested here, the precious metals bulls, for a while. The Fed can't raise, it looks like, much more. Plus, we have the flattening of the yield curve, which implies inversion, maybe as soon as next year. That, of course, recession, maybe in late 2019 or 2020. Add into the fact we have the Euro ministers are now talking very hawkish and looking as though they want to raise rates, which, they, you know, they've held low for so long. The BOE, the Bank of England, and the PBOC are all talking about wrapping up easing. They're all following the Fed's moves of 2 years ago. That implies is you get a blow off top in the U.S. dollar, 2018, early 2019, and that sets the stage for Bill Murphy's explosive rally thesis.
Of course, it's just a quiet time. There isn't a whole lot of new stuff to impact the markets that we can get into, I don't think. It's just getting through this period and get ready for the excitement that is to come.
It's easy to forget that we also have lull this time of year in the metals as people prepare, you know, for the holiday season buying and purchases and things of that nature. And of course, Diwali and all of the Indian festivals, which and the Chinese New Year. So you add in our festivals here in North America, Europe, Diwali in India, and then the Chinese New Year celebrations, all traditionally big time for jewelers to accumulate their metal stockpile. So maybe we'll see some fireworks later in the year. Bill Murphy, if you could tell us more, please, about La Metropole Cafe.
Well, I've been doing it 20 years. Come this Labor Day, it's been a fun thing to do, and I really enjoyed it. And people can go there to sign up for a two-week free trial, see it is of interest. And then my colleague Chris Powell does a great job with GATA. Go to www.gata.org and can get on his list. And we're going to keep up the good fight to expose the manipulation of the gold and silver markets. And eventually, I think that what's the reason they're going to blow up, and it's taking a long time, but eventually the bad guys are going to run out of enough physical metal to keep these prices artificially low, and we're just going to take off.
You know, I'd like to continue that thought as we wrap up. Look at the case study in Venezuela. You know, in just about a year's time, and suddenly it's over a million bolivars. What do you do? I mean, sure, you had a little bit of savings. Maybe you had something hidden under the couch, but if you had precious metals, you would still have virtually the same purchasing power that you had. You're doing a lot better than maybe the neighbors. If you knew the storm that would have the lightning bolt that was going to strike your home, you wouldn't have to put up the lightning rods, right? I mean, you wouldn't have to have the safeties in place. But we don't know when lightning's going to strike. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
So glad you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, Wolf Richter from Wolf Street. Well, welcome back, Wolf Richter.
Thanks for having me back.
Obviously, a lot going on in California today. Some serious fires there in the, I believe it's Redding area, as well as, correct me if I'm wrong, Mendocino?
Mendocino, yeah. There's a three-county fire, so it has spread over. It's called the Mendocino Complex Fire. But it's really covering three counties, and it is, in terms of surface area, by far the largest fire in California's recent history. So, it's fire season. We have two seasons in California, you know, rainy season, if it's raining, and fire season. And fire season seems to come earlier, and it's just ferocious these last few years.
Exactly. They're showing maps I've seen on CBS and other stations where an area so large that covers considerably more than New York City. This is a real tragedy.
Yeah, I'm not talking right now. There are over 300,000 acres in that one, in the Mendocino Complex fire that has been burned down. So far, in terms of lives lost this year, it's bad, you know, but it's not quite as bad as last year. But the fire season just started. It's just the beginning, you know. It's going to go into October, November probably, depending on when the rainy season starts. And a lot of these fires are probably not going to completely die down until the first rains are coming.
There's a lot of misconceptions surrounding the issue. We've heard talk about how, well, they've diverted too much water to the sea and whatnot. But in reality, local officials have confirmed that there is ample water to fight these fires. One of the big issues, other than obviously the dry vegetation and whatnot, overgrowth. They haven't had the opportunity to cut back the foliage. And as a result, there's plenty of tinder to fan the flames. Add to that, as you say, the seasonal factors and the arid conditions. But, you know, really our thoughts and prayers go out to California because this is becoming a huge issue. Even those who haven't lost their lives or their homes have been displaced. I mean, they're having to evacuate, as I'm sure you've seen, entire communities. Looking through your great Wolf Street site, and one of the things that catches the eye right off is your GDP review. You know, we saw some big numbers last week, 4.1 revised in the latest monthly. Your analysis seems to indicate indicate that the GDP is likely somewhat off kilter. Can you tell us more, please?
The headline GDP number that we're looking at in the United States is really a very volatile number that you or maybe no other country uses. We're looking at a GDP growth rate from the prior quarter. So in Q2, it was a growth rate from Q1, so the change, but annualized, so essentially multiplied by four. And these numbers are extremely volatile, and I posted a chart to show this. It goes, during the financial crisis, this quarterly change annualized, so multiplied by four, really went to almost minus 9% in one quarter. Now in Q2, it hit 4.1%, but under, you know, we've been over 4.1, over 4%, over 4.1%, several times during the period since the financial crisis. Higher, actually. Four times we were above that rate under the Obama administration. So this is Trump's first four-plus GDP number. And because this number is so volatile, it reverts to the mean. The reversion to the mean can be brutal. It can be followed by a series of very lousy GDP reads. So what I like to look at is the more standard, in globally speaking, way of measuring GDP growth, and that's the actual annual growth. So in the second quarter compared to the second quarter a year ago. And that's the normal GDP figure that is being cited. It's the annual GDP growth. That was 2.8%. And that's pretty good. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at compared to where we've been. But it's not out of range. We've had those growth rates in prior quarters, but it's at the upper end, at the upper range, you know, of where we've been since the financial crisis. And we've been as low as 1.6%. And as high as 3.8% since the financial crisis. So this is in the upper range, and it's good. I mean, the economy is good, but it's not growing at a 4.1% annual rate. I mean, that's the second quarter annualized, so essentially multiplied by four, and that's a mean reverting number. And we will see a reversion to the mean over the next few quarters.
You know, we talk about reversions to the mean. Generally, economists look for 2 to 3 quarters back-to-back of negative GDP growth before calling a recession. Our policymakers tend to be the last to know. They're looking more in the rearview mirror as far as the potential for an economic downturn. What is your analysis? Do you have a projection or even a forecast on whether or not you see in 2019 a slowdown or perhaps even a recession?
Definitely in 2018, I don't see a recession. I mean, I don't think that's happening this year. So that's, for me, that's off the table. I mean, we could have some kind of crisis that would trigger the beginning of a recession in 2018, but I just don't see that happening. 2019, I think, has a considerable probability of a recession. You know, I don't see any data right now to forecast a recession in 2019. Right now, the goods-producing economy in the United States is very strong, and it has been through a recession in 2015, 2016. That's not the service sector. That's the goods-producing sector, and we've seen transportation decline substantially during that period. In the service sector, you know, it held up, but the GDP growth in 2016 was 1.6% because of the recession in the goods-producing economy. Right now, the goods-producing economy is really strong. And so we've seen pricing and freight surge. There's a truck shortage. Railroads are happy. It's really hard to get things shipped on time right now because inventories are being built up and growing backlogs. And so the goods-producing economy is really strong. But that's a very cyclical part of the economy. And I don't know where the peak is of that cycle, but we may be close to it. And then once that cycle trends lower, you know, you'll have a slowdown in the goods-producing sector. That may still not produce a recession, but it's going to slow down the economy to some extent. And if it coincides with a slowdown in the service sector, that's when you'll get a recession. The service sector is bigger, so that's really the thing to watch. The service sector includes housing. Housing is still strong. Construction, I mean, the rents are, that's part of the service sector. Construction is part of the goods producing sector. So rents are still rising. The whole housing industry, finance, all that is still strong. But that's being targeted by the Fed. So the Fed's trying to take some of the exuberance out of these asset prices, and it is named commercial real estate, which is apartments, among other things, specifically housing complaining about in some situations being elevated and so forth. So the Fed is targeting some of those sectors. We have not seen any impact yet of that targeting. The markets have brushed that off. But this is going to eventually sink in, and this may happen in 2019, and then we'll see a slowdown in the service sector, perhaps combined with a slowdown in the goods-producing economy, and that would make a noticeable impact. It could trigger what then will be an official recession.
I'd like to keep with that thought with the real estate and housing sector. Wolf Street does a great job keeping an eye on the Case-Shiller housing indexes, and you'd like to break it down city by city. Seattle, Boston, Chicago, many others. So let's talk about your latest article here on the topic, The Most Splendid Housing Bubbles in America, posted July 31st. I'd like to give you a chance to break down some of the cities that you think are in bubble territory.
There's different ways of reporting home prices, and the Case-Shiller index is one of those, and it's very peculiar and different from other measures in that it measures the price changes of the same home as it's being sold over time. So when a house was sold in 2012 and then it gets sold in 2018, the Case-Shiller measures that difference, and it uses algorithms to adjust that and come up with its index. So it's not a median price index. It measures sales pairs, and so in that respect, it's very different, and it gives a little bit of different results than when we look at median prices. And it lags behind, so it lags about 3 months or so behind. So what we're looking at is what happened in terms of the housing market a few months ago, and it's not what's happening today. In this respect, the Case-Shiller has a national index. It's very strong. It rose 6.4% for that month compared to a year ago. Yeah, that 6.4% goes across all the cities that it measures. Or really, it measures metropolitan areas. In terms of San Francisco, for example, it measures a five-county area around San Francisco. It's never just a city in Dallas and in L.A. and all these cities. You know, it measures the metroplex around it. So there's a very broad-based index. And the national index combines those city indexes that it has. And 6.4% increase year over year is pretty significant when you think about, you know, wages rising at less than half that rate. And that's been the case for many, many years, that home prices have outgrown wages. Now, people say we should adjust this for inflation, but, you know, a home price index like this is a measure of inflation. It's a measure of asset price inflation, specifically of housing inflation. So it measures, these houses don't get bigger. You know, the same house doesn't get bigger or more valuable. The in that sense, like a company sales grow, you know, and then it will become more valuable as its profits go up. A home that you live in doesn't grow. And so when the price goes up, it's a sign of asset price inflation. And that's what this index measures. In some cities, and so this, the national index was high, you know, 6.4% increase. That's pretty strong. In some cities, particularly in Seattle, we have a spike going on that is just dizzying. When you look at the chart, I mean, it's just the chart goes back to about 2000. You know, that spike is just of the last few months. It's just incredible. And it is like from month to month as well as 2%. I mean, that's a very strong rate in terms of annual growth. It's up 14% from a year ago. It's now up 34% from the peak of the prior housing bubble. So this is measuring from the peak of the bubble to the current prices. And you know, we called the prior housing bubble a housing bubble for a reason. You know, afterwards, after it collapsed, you know, we said it wasn't sustainable. It was now the new normal is like, oh, wow, that's a period of stability compared to where we are today. So in Seattle right now, the home prices are, according to the Case-Shiller, 34% higher than they were above peak of the prior housing bubble. In Denver, it's 53% higher than the peak of the prior housing bubble. In Dallas, it's almost 50% higher. And in some other cities like Atlanta, which had enormous house price increases during the prior housing bubble, and then huge plunges, the current are just above the prior bubble. So in Atlanta, it's 7% above the prior peak right now. Angeles, which had another incredible housing bubble. You know, when you look at the chart, it's just like a sugar cone. You know, the home prices more than doubled from 2002 to the peak of 2006, I mean, just shot up and then collapsed. I brutally collapsed and then had a bottoming out process. And then started rising again, and now they're 3% above that incredible peak during the prior housing bubble. So every one of these major cities that I looked at has now exceeded the peak of the prior housing bubble in terms of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. In San Francisco, you know, we're 40% above the prior peak. And the prior peak, I mean, that was an incredible period.
Your Case-Shiller work on Dallas, 47% above the peak, and if we do peak to trough, 50%. What's driving this? I mean, obviously, there's record demand. If we turn back to 2006 to 2007, I think it was really obvious that we would have a downturn. You had the Altays, the Ninja loans. Anyone who could fog a mirror could get a loan. What's driving this market today? We don't see that subprime question mark, or do we? Because you've had some unique thoughts in this area. That subprime is still lurking behind this market.
There's subprime lending out there, but in terms of the banks, you know, that's where the problem was last time. In part, you know, there were non-bank lenders that collapsed very quickly, and they were allowed to collapse. But a big part of the subprime lending was handled by the big banks last time. That's not happening this time. The subprime lending these days, the big banks have become fairly prudent with that. Their loan underwriting is pretty strong. They've learned somewhat of a lesson, I would think. But the subprime lending has moved off to non-bank lenders, and so they're not regulated as heavily or not regulated at all in that respect. Those are the ones that were allowed to collapse without question last time. And there were several of them. You know, they just fell apart. Now, Quicken Loans has become the largest mortgage lender in the country. So that's a non-bank lender and is not regulated and is now outgrown Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo used to be the largest mortgage lender, and Quicken Loans, in part because of the subprime lending and the very aggressive online lending and their underwriting standards that are not nearly as strong. And we have a whole slew of other non-bank lenders, and these are the shadow banks.
That's what I wanted to get to, because I think we've discussed this maybe via email. A lot of what may be occurring here is HUD and some of the other major lenders, the federal authorities, for the most part, have taken over the reins. Now it really is the government that's underwriting much of this bubble this time around. I'd like to know whether or not you see that as a potential Achilles heel to put the taxpayer even further at risk during the next downturn.
In terms of much of the subprime lending is not government guaranteed. Now, there are some aspects of subprime lending, and the VA, you know, and other organizations guarantee some smaller numbers in terms of subprime. There will be some hits. You know, the government will take the government, meaning the government-sponsored enterprises. Ginnie Mae is part of the government. So they will take a hit. But it won't be as catastrophic on subprime as we might think. I think the biggest hit will be taken by these non-bank lenders that, you know, they can't necessarily sell their mortgages, their subprime mortgages, especially to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So a lot of them have to raise their funds in other ways, and some of them is bank lending, so they go to the largest banks and get large loans from them. And they also do asset-backed securities. So the risk from these shadow banks is actually spread out. And that's good. And for the taxpayer, that's good. You don't want to be backing these shadow banks, but it's in investors' portfolio. The risk is sitting in pension funds and in bond funds, and it's sitting on bank balance sheets, spread among many banks, yeah, but it's dispersed. So the risks are more on the investor side this time, I think, than on the taxpayer side.
I'd like to illustrate San Francisco, which you led off with, from trough all the way to the recent peak. So we're talking maybe 2009, 2010, up to the current levels. That's a 70% or ascent from those low levels. Is this sustainable? Is this a new paradigm? Have we reached a permanent plateau, as Fisher said? As you said earlier, a return to the mean at some point.
San Francisco is a boom and bust town. All of California is, but San Francisco in particular, that was bred into the economy during the gold rush, and it has not disappeared. And everybody here knows this. So if you look at median prices, so going away from the Case-Shiller, but going to median prices, median house prices have more than doubled from the trough. So that's 100%, over 100% increase in those 10 years, really 8 years. Trough was in 2011, so it's really 7 years. And that's a huge, huge increase. And there is no plateau in San Francisco ever on anything. And I know a lot of people in real estate, commercial real estate, as well as residential real estate, and people that have been in this business for 20-plus years, they say this feels worse in that sense of frothier than it did in 1999. San Francisco's economy essentially collapsed in 2000 because the employership, the employees, the people left. It was too expensive, and San Francisco emptied out. And there's a lot of people leaving and lots of empty apartments. This didn't really happen in 2008, 2009 because the bailouts were so strong and so quick. And the money from you know, venture capital and so forth started flooding into San Francisco very quickly. But in 2000, that didn't happen. And there was a long period where people just left and apartments stood empty and prices dropped and office space stood empty and prices dropped. And that was a real bust, you know, the kind that nobody really wants to live through. And the people that have been in this business for a long time, they said, today, this is even frothier than it was in 99. And they expect a downturn perhaps worse than what, for San Francisco, you know, than what we're seeing. Because it's so expensive. People lose their jobs. They can't stick it out here. They have to leave, you know. You can't, you know, if you pay $3,000 a month for a tiny little apartment, and you lose your job and you've got a few thousand dollars in the bank, pretty soon you realize, I get out of here. You know, I got to go back home, go knock on mom's door and see if she let me in. And this is what's happening in San Francisco regularly when, you know, when the economy, the local economy turns south and some of the venture funded companies are letting people go. And if that happens, they leave. They don't have roots here. They'll leave. And that happens very quickly. You know, they once they're laid off and they decide they can't stay here, you know, they're gone. And then you'll see a bust in the housing market and probably in the office market of the type probably that we saw in 2000 through, you know, 2004 in that range. And people have been in this business for a long time. They expect this. They now openly talk about it. They just don't know when it will happen, but they say this is going to happen again. This is boom and bust, and right now we're somewhere near the peak of the boom, and it can't go on much further.
Obviously, the Fed could likely be winding down its rate increases. We're looking for maybe one more increase in September and perhaps another in December. At the same time, you know, the EU economic ministers are looking to likely increase rates and curtail their quantitative easing. We're also hearing in Asia. It might just put the U.S. dollar in a less favorable position as soon as early 2019. Do you see that as at least a little better for the precious metals?
Yeah, precious metals are an incredibly frustrating investment right now, have been for years, as we all know. I have trouble relating the dollar to gold, for example. You know, they seem to move in different ways, especially the last few years. But I know that, having been in this for enough decades, that cycles with precious metals are very, very long. An up cycle can last 10 years or more, and down cycles can last as long or longer. And I've been through that. I mean, the first big loss I've had was in silver, which I bought in the early, like 1981 or something like that, after it had collapsed by 30 or 40%, you know, and I thought, okay, this is a great time to buy. And then a year later, or a year and a half later, I sold it at a 50% loss, and it continued to lose money into the 2000s. And it's now back where it was when I bought it in 1981. These cycles are horribly long when you're on the wrong side of it. And it's very frustrating, and you have to have an enormous amount of patience. And, you know, I own some silver, and to me, it's something that I own, period. And I don't even pay any attention to whether it goes up or down because, you know, it's the metal I own, and that's what you have. And I don't expect any major change in direction in gold and silver in 2019. I just don't think we're long enough into the down cycle. I mean, there's going to be ups and downs like we've seen in the past few years, but in terms of the long-term trend, you know, we're just a few years into this, and I just don't see the cycle turning. You know, it may go up 15 or 20%, and then it'll go back down, and it may hit, it may carve out a new decade low, you know. And I think people into precious metals have to be accepting of this. The people who do day trading and the futures market, you know, that's a different story. But if you own the metal, the long-term cycles is really something that you have to accept. And if you accept them, you know, it's not that frustrating because you know they're there. And when the next up cycle comes, it will last a very long time also. You don't really, it's hard to time, and you just own the metal and enjoy it and wait for the next big up cycle without too much frustration. That's how I look at it. I just don't expect a big upturn next year in precious metals.
You know, another market pretty well correlated with the precious metals is obviously U.S. equities. As long as investors continue to pour funds really on a global basis into U.S. stocks and shares, and that obviously is going to diminish any interest in safe haven assets, and precious metals top that list. As we wrap up, anything you'd like to share with the listeners, maybe some topicality that I haven't brought up today?
I want to point out that one really important thing that I stress on my website, which is the transportation sector, particularly trucking and railroad. And if you want to get a feel for how the goods producing economy is doing, look at trucking. And trucking is on cloud nine right now. Truck orders, heavy truck orders, hit an all-time record. They're up by close to 200% from a year ago in terms of demand for trucks. And it follows an incredibly strong increase for shipping goods across the country. This is something we need to keep our eyes on. You know, the goods producing sector in the U.S. economy is doing extremely well right now, and everybody on the inside is already saying this cannot last like this. You know, we cannot move further. Or in terms of the economy looking forward, the trucking sector is something that we can use as a thermometer, and right now it's as hot as it's ever been. And when that turns, I think we'll get the first major signal that there may be a slowdown coming.
This must be one of the most hated markets, at least bull markets, in U.S. equities that we've ever seen.
It's extremely overvalued. I mean, that's part of the problem. After 8 years of bull market, the shares are overvalued. I mean, the economy is strong, but the shares are overvalued.
The charts will give you a nosebleed, but I will keep an eye on transportation. Do you have any hypotheses as to why trucking is so red hot now?
But there's a lot of theories out there, and part of it is the investment tax credit. Companies have moved their investments forward to benefit from that. The fear of tariffs could be a possibility. The cycles of the goods-producing economy is a very cyclical part of the economy, and it went through a recession in 2015, 2016. It came out of that recession in 2017, and now we're in the boom cycle, and it's going to go back into a recession at some point in the future. But the boom cycle is exaggerated. I mean, it's not how this is going, and inventories are building up. Now, that's part of the boom cycle. When inventories get too heavy, you know, people cut back the orders, that brings on the recession. But right now, inventories are building. The companies have trouble getting the merchandise, so there's this kind of scramble going on, you know, to hire trucks to get your merchandise shipped, and everybody's trying to speed everything up because the delays are there. So I know it's going to take me a week longer to get my merchandise shipped, I'm going to bring the orders forward. It has that sort of mentality to it that you get in very frothy periods, and that's what's happening in the trucking sector right now. And it's just incredible. And it can't last. You know, these things cannot last. They're self-correcting, and we will see that. We'll see that probably later this year, and I'll make sure to write about it on my site. Thanks for having me back, Chris.
Featured guest today says the European Central Bank is at risk of failing, which could send interest rates soaring, outlines contingency plans for investors to shield their portfolios. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You know, the Fed meeting minutes, they showed very little new guidance on policymakers' plans. The markets shrugged off the latest meeting minutes. Give us an idea of your take on the situation.
The real issue is that you kind of have to understand what's really behind it. Janet Yellen used to come out all the time and say, look, we have to normalize interest rates. The Fed's claimed, you know, 2% target for inflation. It's been chronically undershot. And mainly because we're in this mode of people don't really trust the future. They aren't rushing out and borrowing money, and even, retail participation in the stock market, still about half the levels that it was in 2007. You have a lot of people that are still behind the eight ball in real estate. I actually have a friend who is a real estate guy, and his house up in New Jersey, he can't even afford to sell it because it's worth less than the mortgage. So he just rents it out. That's it. So, I mean, the Fed is basically saying we have to normalize interest rates, and it's the code word for really what, the chronic problem. Central banks lowered rates thinking that they would stimulate demand, and it just didn't work. And now what they've done is they've undermined all the pension funds. You have even, CalPERS in California talking about raising taxes because they're below funding levels. Illinois, that state's basically bankrupt. All over the place. I mean, Europe is a complete disaster. Americans are always, very myopic. They only look at United States. They're not paying attention to what's happening in Europe. Even the Great Depression, sure, there was a minor correction in the stock market from 29 into 30. What really sent the stock market down dramatically to 10 cents on the dollar was the sovereign debt crisis. That hit in 1931. And how did it start? It started with the bank going over in Austria. The bank happened to be one of the owners was Rothschilds. So when the rumor hit that the Rothschilds were going bust, then they started selling bank shares. It turned into a contagion. I mean, you can go online and just read Herbert Hoover's memoirs. They're free. From 1931. And what he explains is that capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of a hurricane. He said it was rushing from one, thing to the next, and they couldn't form a committee fast enough to figure out what was going on. Anybody in the industry, you can apply those words to 2010. As soon as Greece went down, what did the traders do? They looked around and said, made a lot of money on this one. Who's next? Oh, Portugal. Then they went after Portugal, then Spain and Italy, etc. This is the way contagions happen. Right now, the FDIC has just put Deutsche Bank on the watch list as a problem bank, and that's the biggest bank in Europe. We have a major banking crisis in Europe.
Didn't we see sort of a canary in the coal mine emerge last year with the Carillion disaster emanating from London, where this construction behemoth just imploded virtually overnight, taking down billions of dollars of investment money? And it emerges later that it was the best well-known disaster out there, that all the smart money had been shorting it for months.
I mean, Deutsche Bank's basically the same thing. I mean, there's been probably articles I've written about it that, I mean, they have a derivative portfolio of about $45 trillion. Now, you net it out, it's still worth three or four times the capitalization of the bank. You have to ask yourself, this is the way the smart money looks at this. Everybody knows that there's a problem with Deutsche Bank, but it's too big. You would normally merge a bank that's in trouble. And that's how they operate. So the only other bank in Germany is Commerzbank, and that has the same kind of problem. This is why the euro doesn't work. The only bank you could possibly merge it with would be BNP, and that's French. Now you have the political problems of Europe. Oh, well, we can't let the French bail out the Germans. It's all political. The bail-ins, people misunderstand what bail-ins are. It's not basically because they don't want to bail out, the bankers again. That's not really the issue. The issue is, in Europe, if the Italian banks go down, then the Germans and the Dutch go, well, gee, we want to put in our money to bail out the Italians. We all knew they had a problem. This is where the bail-in comes in. No, you're not going to get any money from the rest of us, so you're just going to have to take it in from all the investors there and anybody that has money in the bank. That's really what the bail-in's about. I mean, this is why the euro is failing. It was a single currency, but they never got past all the political ramifications in the history, the bad taste in everybody's mouth from two world wars.
Let's move over to the precious metals for a minute. Every time the market looks like it's ready to break out of this two-year-long consolidation, roughly, the greenback seems to move against it, putting it under some pressure, especially with the likelihood of at least another rate hike in June and then maybe one more in December this year. It seems to have investors less concerned about safe haven investments against the backdrop of what we see in North Korea and, of course, in the Middle East. What are your thoughts on gold and silver?
We're still in this consolidation mode, and you're correct in the sense that, you know, you have the what they call the gold bugs, and they'll buy gold no matter what happens. But that's not enough to get people to to actually want to run out and buy gold. The average person on the street has to get to that stage where they don't trust government, and we're not there yet. After 2020, you know, then the story will change, but we're still in this period of consolidation, and you have to understand, with the problems that we see outside the country, in Europe, I mean, Japan, the big money, there's only one place to go, and that's the dollar. I mean, we saw, you know, with the Italian elections and the crisis in the euro this past week, I've been warning people. I said, you know, your interest rates can go to 10% overnight. And they thought, oh, that's absolutely ridiculous. Well, in Italy, interest rates went from 0.3% to 2.5% in one day. You have to understand what this quantitative easing has done. The Fed has backed off. The Fed has also said whatever they bought, it will mature and they will not rebuy it. Okay, that's responsible. So the Fed is reducing its balance sheet. Everybody bashes the Fed all the time. Nobody looks outside this country. You had Bank of Japan stand up and brag. They thought it was good. They bought 97% of their own debt. In Europe, why did interest rates rise so fast in a single day in Italy? Because the only buyer is the ECB. Both of them have destroyed their local bond markets. I mean, a pension fund is not going to buy debt from Italy for 10 years at 1.3%. They need 8% to break even. Who's going to buy this stuff? It's all manipulated. The central banks of Japan and Europe have been the buyers. That's it. There is no other buyer. So this is why the dollar goes up. For big money, the only place they can come is the United States. There's no competition.
Move on to the U.S. equities markets. You've outlined correctly in recent interviews that you watch the international monetary flows, I should say money flows, from outside the United States certainly help keep price elevated in recent years. You're one of the ones to correctly call this. We've only had a handful of bulls, permabulls, remain on the show, and you've been right so far. Do you see any reason to change that outlook?
Our model's, you know, very specific, and how fast it would elect a buy signal is critical. Like from 1929, it elected a monthly sell signal the very first month. All right, in 1907, I think it took 3 months. We're not even remotely close to a monthly sell signal. We warned it, okay, fine, yes, we're going to have a high in the Dow in January. And in the first half of this year would be consolidation. This is because people are just trying to figure out where we're going. But then you had, you know, the NASDAQ make new highs in March. And here you have the Russell 2000 going up, making new highs. Now, that's more of the mutual fund place to park money. So that index is different than the S&P, the NASDAQ, and the Dow. The Dow tends to reflect more of international capital. But with interest rates this low, honestly, the only shot is good equities. That's it. You know, there have been a number of government-run pension funds in various states. They ran off into emerging markets trying to get higher yield.
If you try to chase after debt, you're taking on an awful lot of interest rate sensitivity and exposure to higher rates, whereas if you turn to equities and you do catch that dart that happens to be the one that has the high alpha, you know, you might really outperform other portfolios. Do you expect this trend to continue? Do you see, as maybe inflation starts to reemerge, that equities remain robust? Could we see a doubling in the Dow from here to, say, you know, 40,000, 50,000?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what our model's been projecting. I know a lot of people are like, oh, you know, that sounds crazy. But, you know, the amount of money in sovereign debt alone is over $200 trillion globally. You're not even talking about, you know, a major shift. When, you know, as the smart money goes, you know, I just can't take this anymore, and they just move to equities. This thing gets to explode. I mean, you can go to our site at Armstrong Economics. I posted charts on the PE ratio. all right, going back decades. The actual peak was 2009. Everybody goes, well, why would the PE, you know, peak almost 200% in 2009? Because at that point, what happens is smart money realizes what's the risk of going down any further at this point versus the government, and they're all in trouble. They just look at it and say, at this point, I'll just park my money. Do you really want to, you know, buy government debt at that point when it's negative? So if they put money into the blue chip equities, which is what they did, if they break even, they're ahead of the game.
It's almost a self-reinforcing vortex because you have the upward momentum brings in companies to purchase up their shares, and then that leads to a lower float, higher prices. As we said earlier, there is nowhere else to make your capital productive. Let's maybe jump forward, though, to the end game. Do you expect to see something similar to 2000, dot-com blow-off, or might it be something like 2008, you know, the Great Recession?
Historically, you can go back basically hundreds of years. And a lot of people heard, you know, of Andrew Jackson fighting the Bank of the United States and shutting down the central bank back then. You know, they cheered. Well, what happened was instead of a central bank where you parked your money, they parked it in all the state different banks. And then that just led to corruption. You can go on eBay and buy called the broken banknote. Or every bank issued its own paper money. Every single bank. And then they start going bust. So then the states tried to bail out their local banks, and then the states went bust. So the sovereign debt crisis of the 1840s was all the states going down. I mean, a number of the states just, you know, defaulted on their debt permanently. So then the 20s, all right, we had the European governments default. We had Asia defaulted. Britain even went into a moratorium. Eventually they came out of it. So sometimes you have, it's like a Shakespeare's play. It can be played out for hundreds of years. It's always the same plot, but the actors change. Sometimes it's the sovereign debt as far as federal is concerned. Then other times it's the private sector. Then other times it's the municipal level. All right, this time we have municipal and federal both in trouble. It's not the corporate side. So, you know, this is why the stock market is, you know, has been going up, and it's going to go up higher. You know, the problem isn't in the equity side. The problem is government.
You don't really charge anything at the website there, do you?
No, you don't even have to register. Expect people's privacy.
I mean, that's quite a public service you're providing. I mean, if you don't have a financial motive, is it an educational that drives your content?
Pretty much. I mean, honestly, look, I've done very well in my life. I don't really need to work anymore, but I've also dealt with governments for, you know, close to 40 years. And I just ended up in a very unusual position. What it was that I was called in back in 1985 when they were going to form the G5. There were 35 of us. And at first I thought, wow, I guess I made it, you know. And so then you realize, you know, gee, you know, okay, Mr. Armstrong, how do we save the world? Oh, very sorry, your 15 minutes is up next. Then they stand up and they say what they wanted to say all along. And then they pretend that they relied upon all these experts, of which what they're doing, nobody recommended.
That's the MO, isn't it? I mean, you can see that even down to the PTA meeting. They already have the solution, and they just want you to feel like you've been part of a consensus that came to the solution, and it doesn't work out that way.
Yeah, I was literally told, because at that point, you can go on our site and you'll see. I wrote a letter to the White House, because I said, you know, this is a waste of time, basically. I got a two-page letter response, and only because I was part of this committee, so they had to really respond to me. They basically, and I warned them, I said, if you're going to lower the value of the dollar by 40% with this G5 stuff, I said, you know, you just sold a third of the national debt to basically Japan. Don't you think you're going to sell this stuff? And they just look at you and their eyes glass over. They have no clue of the financial markets at all. I warned them, volatility is going to go up. Within 2 years, you're going to cause a crash. That was the 87 crash. So then when the 87 crash comes, then they're calling me, oh, gee. I said, I'm sorry. You know, I'm not interested. Then they started lobbying my friends so that I would go in. And then when I go into this Brady Commission thing, you know, it starts off with the same thing. They have some academic from some university, and he said, well, we're going to try and find the guy that forced this market down. And I said, excuse me. I said, every investigation since 1907 has begun the same way. You never found any mythical giant short. What makes the market go down? I said, you even understand how a market trades. Yeah, I borrow a stock from one person and I sell it to the other. I said, okay, fine. So how does a short position ever outnumber the longs? It can't. I said, in futures, everything's matched. And he's just looking at me, and he says, well, I teach finance at one of the major universities. I said, that's very nice. On well over $1 trillion. I understand what goes on. And he says, well, what makes it go down? I said, you've never traded, have you? I said, everybody's long. It could be anything that comes out. And all of a sudden, they try to sell. And you get into these downdrafts, there's no bid. So all of a sudden, a Dow can drop 1,000 points in a single day. I said, it's no bid. Nobody's shorting it. And they try to sell, there's nobody there.
Then add to the mix, you have 70 to 90% of the NYSE volume now likely automated trading, robotic trading, some people refer to it, facing a scenario where even the robots are turned off and there's absolutely no bids across the board. We saw a flash crash, you know, something like that, I guess, is what you're also referring to.
Yeah, I mean, the robots will shut down. And the danger is something like that happens so rapidly.
Any further thoughts on the markets? I mean, my guess is you probably have a gut feel for what we should expect for the second half of 2018.
Pay more attention, basically, to Europe. The euro has come down dramatically. I mean, it's a currency that is absolutely doomed. You really, there's no hope of saving this thing. You know, you have a single currency, but you don't have a single continent. And everybody's, oh, we're not going to bail out them because that's the Italians or that's the French or this. Everybody's against everybody else still. And that's the problem. I mean, once you undermine that confidence, then everything starts to come unglued. That's when you see the stock market starting to rise dramatically. The Fed will raise interest rates because they need to raise them simply to try and save the pension funds. This is not even about inflation. This is about effectively just trying to get the monetary system and saving it.
If you were going to construct a mythical portfolio for, you know, just the typical American, is there anything that you'd add or try to keep out of that portfolio this time? Maybe a solid base of gold, silver, precious metals, XAU?
Just have to keep in mind that the big money institutions, they don't buy gold. They can't run down and buy $20 gold pieces and stuff like that. So gold is more of a retail market avenue. Institutions can go into the equity side, gold stocks, things of that nature. But the one thing you definitely don't want to have is any form of government bonds whatsoever. Municipals, federal, get out of any of that sort of stuff. If you want any kind of fixed income, just go to AAA companies and keep it short term. Don't go buy any of these 100-year bonds that they're selling. I mean, that's great. I would look at that because keep in mind that, for example, the last time Italy got in trouble, what did they do? You may have had 30-day paper. They couldn't pay, so they stood up and said, oh, we're not defaulting. We're just converting all 30-day paper into 10-year notes. You know, government can do whatever it wants. The private sector can't do that. IBM couldn't do it, or Apple, or whatever. But governments can do whatever they want, and they are the ones that prosecute people, so they never prosecute themselves. There are no mirrors in Washington.
Tell people a little bit more about the fantastic services you provide online and totally for free, which is a real public service here.
I have the actual experience with governments. I even, you know, you have to understand that they will always act out of their self-interest, period. I mean, I actually had the mandate from Hong Kong to buy land from Australia so that they could have moved. I met with the prime minister several times. And I even said to him, I have a blank check here, selling this island off the coast of Australia, and I'll pay off your national debt. They said no. And I finally got him to say, what is the problem? Why can't we come to some sort of a deal here? And he said, no, they're not labor people. They were afraid that if they allowed the people from Hong Kong to come in, what would happen? They would change the vote, and then the labor government would be out, and they would be in there with conservatives. So it has nothing to do with economics or anything. It's who's going to win at the end of the day.
Speaking of winning, your Forecaster film did quite well, and I'd be remiss if I didn't inquire into any further projects. I know you've had some on the drawing board for a while.
Yeah, no, they are doing a Hollywood movie. They're turning into a Hollywood movie. They want to do another one of the Forecaster, but from concerning Europe and everything else and dealing with it from that perspective. So, but it's just an example of how corrupt the system has become. And it's just really ridiculous. When that film debuted in Amsterdam, the third night we had all the bankers from, all over Europe. And the moderator wanted to pretend he was, unbiased. But he says, oh, so did you ever, whatever happened to the $1 billion? You got to keep it? What? And I said, why don't we just ask the audience? I said, is it possible for $1 billion to be missing from a bank and nobody knows where it is? The whole audience starts laughing. I said, you either write a check, you wire it out, or you beam it out like Star Trek. All right, well, take care. Thank you for inviting me.
This is Robert Yen with OldSeat.com Radio. Have you ever felt like you're on the wrong end of the teeter-totter, and some heavy weight or force is on the other end, weighing you down, keeping you stuck, up in the air, too high to jump off, and not knowing when or if the situation will change? That's the situation a lot of people feel like they are in right now, when it comes to the important freedoms that have been established in the United States for nearly 250 years. I'm sure you're familiar with the idea that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It can also be said that power corrupts, and concentrated power, like 90% of the media being controlled by 6 corporations who synchronize their content and narrative into acceptable parameters of debate, as in propaganda, that the rest of us are supposed to abide by, never question, and simply accept. That kind of power corrupts nearly all the time, and we are witnessing that right now. You must protect your First Amendment rights at all cost, because without them, you are not free. It is that simple. Don't let anyone sway you using extreme examples of politically correct this or that to justify any erosion of your First Amendment rights, and by extension, your ability to think. To use your mind to analyze, to judge, to disagree with, and to criticize those in power or who are philosophically different than you are. Persuasion of thought is one thing. Force is something completely different. And when force is disguised as persuasion, for example, through the concentration of media power and its resulting narrative, in an effort to wear you down and force you to submit your free will to others, you must speak up and stand up, even if you are alone in doing so. The ongoing wholesale censorship of independent media creators, whether you agree with them or not, whether their viewpoints are accurate or not, if you truly believe in freedom, that ongoing wholesale censorship by giants like Google, Twitter, Facebook, Apple, and others must challenge your sense of right and wrong at a fundamental core. Apple, for example, who used to advertise their brand as Think Different, by today's standards could easily change that to Think Alike or Else. Google used to use the phrase Don't Be Evil, but according to Gizmodo.com as of May 2018, they report that Google's unofficial motto has long been the simple phrase, don't be evil. But that's over, according to the code of conduct that Google distributes to its employees. The phrase was removed sometime in late April
or early May, archives hosted by the Wayback Machine show. Perhaps the next casualty will be archives like the Wayback Machine, just as other historical information has already been rewritten or expunged from the web in an effort to shape the collective memory of the world. The prize is, was, and always has been your mind, your freedom to think and thereby speak. As in, speak freely, remains an impediment to those who disguise force as persuasion. Way back in 1983, the rock group Styx performed a breakthrough theatrical concert featuring the Mr. Roboto character, where in a distant future, censorship had prevailed and rock music had been banned. I can still hear the live echo of that concert in my mind when Dennis DeYoung, the founder of the band, said, "It's not the music that's in question. It was always the freedom of expression." The freedom of expression is what is in jeopardy today. That distant future is here now. What America represents as of its 250th birthday, coming up on July 4, 2026, will be entirely up to what you do or don't do today. How are you going to respond? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.